It's the Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Now, the end of summer is for improvising with all that amazing stuff out there. Ban recipes. Instead, get your imagination going. Now, for a leg up, I've got some ingredient combos that always work. For France, think shallots, tarragon, butter, and grainy mustard. Roll grilled greens in that. Fabulous. Morocco, cinnamon, cumin, paprika, and olive oil. Brush that on roasting eggplant. And for India, here's Chef Vikas Khanna.
I think there's one chutney which connects the whole country, and that is the green chutney. That could be cilantro, it could be mint, it could be just green chilies, sometimes with dried pomegranate seeds. But these chutneys are crucial.
That is so stunning on sweet corn, you cannot imagine. Stay with us for your calls and a lot more this hour on The Splendid Table. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show for people who love to eat. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Well, today it's the insider's take on many things. For example, why eat fried chicken from a chain when you could bite into the best bird in the area? Jane and Michael Stern of Road Food fame have the Paste It On Your Dashboard list of the finest mom-and-pop chicken joints in the country. We're taken inside the world of real Chinese food and the story behind the woman who brought it to America. Film director Wayne Wang is making a documentary on her life. And wait until you hear his take on real Chinese food. And then there are the stories dishes can tell. That is, if you've got the chops to know the difference between a good tale and what really happened. Now, those chops led award-winning British food writer and editor William Sitwell deep into the archives of the British Library and down some wonderfully unexpected yellow brick roads. He surfaced with his book, A History of Food in 100 Recipes. William, good to have you with us.
Lovely to be here.
So, you've done this immense project, 100 Dishes. What are some of the standouts for you?
Oh, I mean, one of the things that I really enjoyed in the book was discovering some sort of forgotten food heroes. Some people going right way back into the Roman period. I mean, there's a man called Thomas Coriat, who's a great hero of mine, because in 1611, he left the British shores and travelled around Europe. He was tired of London, and he took himself off around Europe, Italy, Spain, France, and so on. Pretty intrepid traveller. He was so intrepid, actually, that they kept his shoes hung outside his local village church for about 150 years before someone stole them. But anyway, he was in Italy, and he discovered two things. The first thing he came across was an umbrella, which he'd never seen before. So he took the idea of that back to England, and everyone laughed at him. But the other thing he discovered was a fork. He saw these Italian gentlemen in a little tavern using a fork. Now, of course, for hundreds of years, up until the early 17th century and beyond, people just used bread to mop up their food and knives to cut it up, and then they just shoved it into their mouths with their fingers. So he saw this fork, and he took it back to the UK, told his friends about it, wrote about it in his book, Coriat's Crudities, and everyone laughed at him. He was known as furcifer, which is an old English word for pitchfork. And it then took about 200 years for the fork to actually catch on. People thought it was just a sort of rather pointless, effeminate, unnecessary part of, you know, getting food into your mouth. And then there's another man, a man called Denis Papin, who in the 18th century worked for the Irish physicist Robert Boyle. But in Papin's spare time, he started experimenting with what he called a steam digester, or engine for softening bones. And this was basically an early pressure cooker. And he reckoned that this would be a wonderful device to help the poor cook meat and make meat more palatable. And he said also that you could use it for making drinks that wouldn't give you a hangover. He managed to produce puddings out of this thing. He produced this amazing book, which I saw, had held in my hands in the British Library. But poor old Papin was ignored by the Royal Society when he presented his ideas, and he sort of died in a pauper's grave. And about 10 years later, someone patented his own ideas and made a fortune from it. So that's two heroes of mine from food history that people don't know about, so I like to talk about them.
Anybody who's more modern that stayed with you after all that work?
Well, there is a man called Clarence Saunders, who is one of the great figures from food history, because in the early part of the 20th century, he invented the modern supermarket. He was brought up in Massachusetts. He was a poor man, very little money. His mother died when he was young. His father was a laborer, a bit of a profligate, a bit of a drunk. This guy had a very poor upbringing. But then he found his métier working in little grocery stores. And when he was in his early 20s, he saved up some money and wanted to start his own store. What's really interesting is he was coming back from Indiana one day when he was on the lookout for new store formats, because the great problem that he had when he was starting up was the inefficiencies in the business, in that people would come at lunchtime, queue up, and they'd be served by men in white coats who would hand you goods. So for the owners of these businesses, they were rushed off their feet at lunchtime, but the rest of the day, all their staff had nothing to do. Now, he was on this train coming back from Indiana, and the train slowed down, and he was thinking, how am I going to fix this problem? I'm not making any money. And he looked out of the window, and as the train slowed down, he saw a pig farm. And it suddenly occurred to him, because he saw a mother sow with six little piglets, and he thought, that's it, self-service. And 3 months later, Clarence Saunders invented Piggly Wiggly, which is still a chain of supermarkets in this country. And he became a millionaire. He made an absolute fortune. And he was obsessed with the pig. He built a pink palace clad in pig-inspired pink render. He put a bowling alley in there. The problem is he also went bust because some various unscrupulous traders on the New York Stock Exchange started shorting on his stock. And he decided that he wanted to buy all his stock back, and he bent and broke a few New York trading rules and went bankrupt and was barred from trading and barred from using his own name. And so he dusted himself down and came back with a new format, a new store, which was called Clarence Saunders, Sole Owner of My Name Stores. So you can tell how angry he was. And that didn't go very well. And then he had two other, he invented a thing called Kadoozle, which is a bit like those arcade games where you put money in the slot and a hand grabs something, you know, puts it on a conveyor belt. And he thought that way people could stand on the streets, put money in, and you wouldn't have any staff. But the problem is all the contraption sort of broke down, everything kind of right, smashed, and it didn't work.
But I'm thinking about how sushi is done, you know, on conveyor belts.
Yeah, it's not similar to that. Exactly. Exactly. So he was a man ahead of his time, and sort of on his deathbed, he invented a thing called Food Electric. And this was a device whereby he said you can have less staff because it's an electronic machine that will read little sort of, well, he didn't call them barcodes, but barcodes on packaging. So you could scan it in and pay a computer. And people said, that'll never happen. Now, of course, that's how so many of us shop these days, you know. We self-scan. Saunders was a great figure. And without him, we wouldn't have the modern format of supermarket. But then perhaps he also precipitated the sort of immense slide into consumerism and food packaging and processing food and food factories and so on. And the kind of, you know, this massive growth in how we eat today.
Well, yeah, but I'd rather think of his inventive side rather than the downside.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, yeah, we would have got here somehow anyway, whether Clarence got involved or not.
Exactly. William, thank you.
Thanks very much indeed.
William Sitwell is editor of the UK magazine Waitrose Food, and he's an award-winning food writer. His book is A History of Food in 100 Recipes. Now, one gem of a dish to try is from 1916, and it's called Spaghetti a la Campbell's, as in Campbell's soup. Now, Campbell's ad campaigns back then were about convincing women that they were failures as wives if they didn't serve their husbands Campbell's soup. Why is there an edge to this that sounds very familiar today? Ah, to have a dollar for every bad meal Jane and Michael Stern have had to eat to find the handful of gems that they bring to their road food site and to us. Their beat is the place still run by locals, the mom and pop spots that still serve great food that has nothing to do with the next new thing. Jane and Michael, good to have you back.
Hey, Lynn.
Hi, Lynn.
You know, I want to do something we've not done before. The best of.
Oh, my favorite subject.
Well, you know, but after all these years of you two finding all these great places, we've never talked about what your picks would be for the best of.
You know, that's not easy, but we will do it for you.
So this is what I was thinking. How about starting with chicken dinners?
Oh, how about that?
So we're talking winner, winner, chicken dinner.
Yes, exactly.
That's a really tough one because there is no part of the country that doesn't have its own wonderful way with chicken dinners. You know, for most of us, I think chicken dinner is comfort food. And for the very best comfort food chicken dinner, the classical one, I would go to Stroud's of Kansas City. It's like pan-fried chicken with natural gravy, real mashed potatoes, cinnamon rolls to go along with it. I mean, it is the classic comfort food country-style chicken dinner.
I love the idea of cinnamon rolls with mashed potatoes.
Yes, of course.
Of course.
This is covering you on all fronts. Okay, so that's fried chicken in Kansas City with the mashed potatoes and the whole thing.
My favorite is Keaton's, K-E-A-T-O-N-S, in Statesville, North Carolina. Probably the only restaurant that Michael and I have eaten at in 40 years where I literally fell out of the booth in it in a swoon of ecstasy. I've never tasted such good chicken. And it's a great place because, like many of wonderful road food places, they have a lot of instructions on the wall.
About how to behave, where to sit. And
like, for instance.
For instance, if once you choose a seat, you do not move from it after placing your order because they will not know where to bring the chicken.
Right. Obviously, you know, no checks and do not raise your voice
very
loudly.
We have to say what's great about Keaton's chicken is that it's fried, and just fried it would be great. But right after it's fried, they dunk it in a vat of boiling barbecue sauce very briefly. And what happens is that just fried chicken kind of sucks in the flavor of the barbecue sauce. So it's sort of a twofer. You get like the crisp, crusty, good fried chicken with that zest of barbecue sauce along with it.
It's a very interesting glazed effect because it reminded me of a candy apple. Not that it's sweet, but, you know, it's
some
almost
crunch.
A crunchy.
Yeah, because the sugar probably actually does form like a candy, right?
Yes.
If there's sugar in the barbecue sauce.
And, yes.
What a brilliant idea.
It is brilliant. And in fact, in Nashville, they've made a whole culture of it. There are several restaurants in Nashville that serve what they call hot fried chicken, all cooked in pretty much the same way, except that most of them, like one called 400 Degrees, another called Pepper Fire, Prince's Hot Chicken Shack. What they do there is they will fry the chicken and then they actually take a brush and paint it with hot sauce to the degree of heat that you want. There's mild, medium, hot, and extra hot that is so insanely hot we've never even tried it.
And, you know, Len, in that part of the country, a lot of our readers, they thought hot chicken meant temperature-wise.
No.
No, you really have to take this seriously. And Michael and I have, I don't know, I don't think we've ever had food that was too hot to eat because we love hot, hot, spicy food. But the extra hot chicken at Keaton's is, I mean, fall out of your booth.
But this sounds like what Buffalo Chicken Wings really wanted to be
when they
started out.
But these are whole, big, beautiful pieces of juicy meat that are infused with all this flavor. It's not just kind of skin and crust. I mean, it's really delicious, satisfying chicken meat.
We took one of our friends, I think it was to the one in Nashville.
A Prince's.
After he ate the chicken, we saw him licking the napkin because there was like chicken juice had got into it.
Well, the way they serve the chicken is on a pallet of supermarket white bread. And it's rare for anyone to really love white bread. But by the time you get through with the chicken on top, that white bread has been infused with the flavor of the chicken. And it, too, is delicious.
And the napkin under the white bread.
I've got an idea for these people. That sounds like the old medieval trencher, you know, where you
ate
off of a piece of bread. They would sell those trenchers.
Really?
And they could sell the chicken-soaked, you know, pieces of white bread as sort of an extra. Of course, you have to not mind that it would come from someone else.
But wait, speaking of extras, there is one bastion of fried chicken that few people know about unless you come from there. The Illinois River Valley has maybe a dozen or more restaurants, mostly taverns, that specialize in excellent fried chicken. The best of them is called Rips in Ladd, Illinois. And in addition to fried chicken, everyone who eats there gets a basket full of what they call crunchies, which are little bits of batter that they retrieve from the frying oil periodically. And what's great is they instruct you to make a finger taco out of these crunchies by picking up a dill pickle and grabbing a bunch of these crunchies. And the theory is not only is that a great taste combination, but the dill pickle kind of cuts the fat so you can eat more fried chicken.
I think that's one of the most brilliant ideas that's come down the road in ages.
It's so delicious.
Right, it's like burnt ends. You know, anything that falls off a roast or a chicken is as good as the chicken or the roast.
Thank you for the chicken tour.
You're very welcome.
Bye, Lynn.
Jane and Michael Stern are the creators of roadfood.com. Find their columns in Savour magazine, and for their latest dining picks, check out the website, splendidtable.org. And while you're there, be sure to check out our Griller's Guide. It's exactly what you need for an end-of-summer blowout barbecue. Get information at splendidtable.org. Now, we're going to be back in a moment with how a Chinese filmmaker unexpectedly learned about real Chinese food in America. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Filmmaker Wayne Wang is from Hong Kong. Now, you know his work, like The Joy Luck Club, The Last Holiday, and now The Soul of a Banquet. Well, here he is from Hong Kong, living an international life with access to everything. So who does he turn to finally understand what real Chinese food is about? Well, he turns to a woman, not in China, but in San Francisco. An amazing woman, not only in his eyes. Ruth Reichel, author of Garlic and Sapphire, sat down with Wayne Wang.
Hi, Wayne. It's great to talk to you.
Hi, great to be here.
So tell me, who is Cecilia Chang and why did you want to make a film about her?
Well, Cecilia Chang is a 94-year-old Chinese woman who grew up in Beijing and who has always loved food and inadvertently became a restaurateur in San Francisco. And she ran a restaurant called The Mandarin. And she, I would say, is the mother of Chinese cooking, at least for the northern style of cooking. She's the mother of Chinese cooking here.
Okay, but why did you decide that you needed to do a documentary about her?
Well, I have known her for so long, I've always felt that someone needs to document Cecilia's life in some ways. And I haven't quite found a way to do it up until a couple of years ago. It was Chez Panisse's 40th anniversary, and Alice Waters were doing a whole bunch of events for the celebration and raising money also for Edible Schoolyards. And I asked Alice, well, what should I do? There's so many choices here. And she said, obviously, you should document Cecilia Chang cooking a banquet for 12 people in her own home.
Okay, how old was Cecilia? This is 2 years ago, right?
This is 2 years ago. At the time, she was 92, maybe.
Oh my God.
She's 94 now.
Yeah.
And she has a mind that's so brilliant and so clear. I mean, she remembers more things than I do.
And you said also that she has more energy than you do, that she can outwalk you.
She can outwalk me. We went out. There's a park right outside her apartment. Every morning she would take a walk around the park, and it's all uphill, downhill, uphill, downhill. I walked with her, and I couldn't keep up with her.
It's amazing.
She has a stick, though. No, I'm kidding.
But you really feel that she is a repository of the history of Chinese food.
Because she's 94 years old, she comes from a history that don't even exist anymore. When she was growing up in Beijing and growing up in China, that was a kind of, you know, cooking that was completely destroyed during the Cultural Revolution. And she's one of the few people that maintains a knowledge of that, especially her parents who were so into food, even though she was not allowed in the kitchen, but the mom would prepare little tidbits of things and have the father taste them, and then the father would criticize, you know, what's right or wrong about the food. And so she learned a lot from that, and she learned a lot from that kind of cuisine, and she brought all that with her to this country, and she truly is a depository for that.
So at 94, she's kind of a living history of Chinese food, and you've captured that. I wanted you to talk a little bit about what you think of the state of Chinese food in the world at the moment.
Well, I'm not completely objective because I grew up basically in the 50s and 60s in Hong Kong, where there were a lot of great Chinese food there, all different kinds. I mean, because all the immigrants went to Hong Kong and they brought their food with them. So there's Northern cooking, there's Sichuan, there's Hunan, there's Shanghainese, there's Cantonese. So I was brought up with all that. And then to taste, for example, Cecilia Chang, the Mandarin, and the more traditional classical cooking, I've been very spoiled. So when I taste the newer, younger Chinese chefs who are doing things that are not based on real knowledge and a classical training, and they're just going out there and saying, this is Chinese food, and whereas it's just sort of a bunch of flavors and a bunch of ingredients put together. I like experimentation, but I think with experimentation, you always need the basic knowledge and the basic training to start with, and then you can then break away from it. I mean, I'm a filmmaker. I came out of a painting background, and that's what I feel about my own art. And I have more respect for the food when it's done with some kind of, you know, training and background.
And you aren't just talking about in the United States, right? You're talking about other parts of the world, too. I mean, you spend time in China and Shanghai. You spend time in Hong Kong.
Yeah, the thing that surprises me is actually China itself. Because of the Cultural Revolution, a lot of the more traditional food has really been, you know, left out or destroyed or no longer exist. There are some good chefs, and they're still maintaining their tradition, but a lot of the food is really, you know, not quite what it should be. It's cooked very differently. It's cooked very fast. It cooked with the wrong ingredients. It's not quite cut right. So that was the biggest surprise for me. And if I really, you know, I travel a lot in Asia. If I really want to get critical about it, actually Taiwan has better Chinese food overall because a lot of the people that escaped the communist regime after the war went to Taiwan, and more chefs went to Taiwan. There are some that went to London, actually, via Hong Kong. So there are pockets of places where there is still really good Chinese food being cooked. And maybe the handing down of that tradition to younger chefs who sort of know that tradition is also there too. But it's not widely, you know, available.
Wayne, lovely to have you. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you. I enjoy being here.
Filmmaker Wayne Wang's documentary on Cecilia Chang is The Soul of the Banquet. Ruth Reichel is the author of Delicious, a novel. Now, you've got to try Cecilia Chang's recipe for lion's head. It's a slow-braised Shanghai dish from Cecilia's home territory. Napa cabbage furls around a big, delicious pork meatball so that it looks like the king of beasts. And you're going to find it at splendidtable.org. Before ketchup, before mustard, before mayo, and before Miracle Whip, even before salsa, there was chutney.
You could see it kind of as India's calling card to the world, along with the greatly misunderstood curry. Few things do for a meal what a chutney can do. Understanding how they're made and used in India, of course, makes sense. One of our go-to Indian experts is Chef Vikas Khanna. He has a Michelin-starred Indian restaurant in New York, Janoon, and a film series, Holy Kitchens. And at the moment, he's filming India's MasterChef series, which he hosts and judges. He joins us from India. Vikas, it's so good to have you back with us.
Absolutely a pleasure. Thank you.
So how does India use chutney?
You know, it's a very funny quotation in our homes. Every time you try to buy something in more volume, and when you bring it home, everyone responds in the same way in India, saying that, what are you going to do with so many apples? Are you going to make a chutney? That is. And on the other side, we have a great quotation, I'm going to beat you up to make a chutney out of you. So I love that chutney is such a common word in our language, that it has so many different meanings. Every time something is abundance, like in April and May, we get a lot of green mangoes. So every home in India makes some form of mango chutney, a mango pickle or anything. And everyone has their own variations. I think the classic chutneys of India, if I have to say, I also consider raita a chutney. Raita is just a yogurt dip, which can have any amount of elements in it.
Yeah.
But it's a yogurt dip, we call it, or yogurt chutney. Chutneys could be one which could be preserved, longer shelf life. Or chutneys could be the instant ones. But I think there's one chutney which connects the whole country, and that is the green chutney. That could be cilantro, it could be mint, it could be just green chilies, and it could be sometimes used with pomegranate, dried pomegranate seeds. But in our homes, we never had a blender. Till I was actually maybe 17, 18, we never used a blender to make all these things. There was a stone, and everything was ground on that stone. Because my grandmother said, if you use a blender to make chutneys, you destroy the textures. So it was always coarse. And initially, I never used to like it. But later, when I started making all the fine chutneys and all those things, now I miss those textured ones more because they would give you a bite. But these chutneys are crucial. And, you know, the word chutney comes from the word to lick, if you translate that word.
Oh, really?
It means to lick. Chaat. Chaat is like, you know, to lick. Some people say, oh, chutney comes from, you know, you lick it because it is so delicious and it's addictive. And I think the second one is tamarind, which almost everyone has to have in some kind of street foods or even with the appetizers.
Oh, sour and fruity, delicious.
It's
yeah.
not only sour. I think tamarind gives a very nice undertone of smokiness and sweetness.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But, and then they add, and that's like what simplest chutney. You can never go wrong with it. I use it as marinations, I use it as spreads, I use in making sorbets. Like, it's multi-purpose. I think just adding a spoon to curries, because lemon gives you the nice, just citrusy acidity. But what tamarind does, it gives you nice acidic flavor, it gives you the sourness, sweetness, and color too.
So let's go back for a moment. The mint, you would want mix that perhaps with green chilies, and it would be fresh?
It was always fresh. It's mint, green chilies, salt. But in our homes, I don't know why, we always use dried pomegranate seeds, always.
Ooh, interesting.
My grandmother said, you can't make it without it. But I said, there's so many different, because she had not traveled. But when I started traveling, I said, you can add yogurt to it, you can add sour cream to it. She's saying, no, you can't make it like that. So once I made a chutney with yogurt, and she loved it. She's saying, oh, this tastes better than mine, because the yogurt gives it that creaminess.
So what foods would you use that with?
It just goes on the side of any appetizer. Fried chicken or, you know, just grilled chicken or chicken tikkas or any kind of fritters. But samosas, you know, the most important dumplings of any kind. But I also think that because India has such a varied choice of chutneys, that even when we have Tibetans who came to India after the revolution in China and Tibet, that even they serve momos in authentic places, they'll serve it with green chutney. I love it.
Those Tibetan dumplings, yes. Oh, that would be fabulous with green chutney.
That is fabulous because it adds one more dimension of flavor to it and the spiciness too.
You know what? I just had an insane thought. A grilled cheese sandwich dipped in that as you went along?
Absolutely.
Insane,
we serve it with everything. You know, my nieces, they eat noodles and they need to have the green chutney.
Interesting.
I'm like, yeah. Even with pizza, they will be ordering green chutney. Can we get some green chutney?
Fikas, thank you very much.
Absolutely an honor for me. Thank you.
Chef Fikas Khanna has written Khanna Sutra, Food Lessons in Love. Well, start your chutney making with one that we spoke about, his cilantro chutney. It's where all good things gather. You know, it's at the Splendid Table. You never call my name. It's time for you and me to talk, so give me a call, 800-537-5252. And remember, you can always connect with us on Facebook and Twitter, or send us an email. Just go to splendidtable.org. Kelly's on the line from Tuscaloosa, Alabama. Kelly, what do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. Thank you for taking my call.
You are welcome.
I have piles and piles of basil, both regular Italian basil and Thai basil, and I was making pesto with the regular basil and was inspired to make some Thai basil pesto, and I am wondering what to do with it.
Well, how does it taste? Do you like the taste?
Oh, it's fabulous. I love it. Yeah.
So how would you describe the taste of Thai basil?
I would say it has a little bit more of a fennel or a licorice-y taste than regular basil.
Yeah.
And it's very pungent, reminiscent of Thai soup or the way a Thai restaurant smells when you walk into it.
I agree with you. It always reminds me of fennel and anise, and yet it tastes like basil as well. So now when you did the pesto, did you do it with the olive oil and the cheese and the nuts? Or?
I didn't. I used coconut oil instead of olive oil. And I use cashews instead of pine nuts.
Oh, that sounds wonderful.
And then I also had some Thai hot peppers that I threw in one of the batches.
Oh, this sounds so good. I can't tell you. All right. Right away, what comes to mind is toss it with rice noodles. You know, soak rice noodles, get them softened, and toss that as a dressing. And then if you want maybe some thin sliced cucumber that you add to that, maybe, I don't know if you can get a hold of green mango, but, you know, unripe mango or papaya would be wonderful. Oh. Or even a really tart apple cut in sticks.
Okay.
Yeah. But the idea is making essentially a Thai style noodle salad would be wonderful. Now, the other thing is you could marinate chunks of meat or fish in that for a short time and then just grill it on skewers. And it would be wonderful.
Sounds really good. What kind of fish would you say?
Well, you know, I want something that had a fair amount of character. So I'm thinking, you know, catfish would be unbelievable.
Oh, yeah. We have a lot of that here.
Yeah. And you could, you know, you could then pan grill it, or you could grill it outside and it would get all crusty and all of that stuff would, you know, kind of caramelize and it would be just delicious. Right. So I think that would be wonderful. And, you know, the other thing is to just use it fresh and take some rice papers, you know, the round discs.
Yes.
And you put them in water just for a few moments and they start to soften. I would just smear that on the rice paper and roll it up like little cigarettes, very narrow, and cut it into little pieces, little short, you know, cylinders. And
oh,
just pop them in your mouth.
That is a brilliant idea. We have some of those rice papers.
Yeah. And, you know, I give it a squirt of lime juice just before you roll everything up.
Oh, yeah, good idea.
I think it's a great idea. So let me review this. You did coconut oil, Thai chili, the Thai basil, and what was the other thing?
Cashews.
Oh, cashews, yes. This is a great idea, and I'm making notes to myself.
Great. Thanks, Lynn. I appreciate it.
You are welcome. Thanks for the call.
Bye.
Bye. We're going to be back with more of your calls, tweets, and other missives. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. We are talking to you this hour. Get in touch, 800-537-5252. Send us an email, splendidtable.org. Find us on Facebook and Twitter. Okay, let's get back to it. We have Tom calling from California. Tom, what's up?
Well, we were wondering what to do with a dozen or so leftover egg yolks that came from boiled eggs.
Oh, so they're cooked.
Yeah, they're already cooked.
Uh-huh.
During the, you know, a lot of times during the summer for a picnic or a garden party, we'll make this side dish that's a sort of a takeoff on deviled eggs. But what we do is we take the egg yolks out, and then we make a guacamole to put in the cavity.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah, it's a great little thing, and they just fly off of the plate. People love them, and it's sort of a really different eye-catching thing on the picnic.
Well, that may be showing up on the Casper table this weekend.
Oh, good.
I love the idea. Okay, but now what to do with those egg yolks? All right, yeah. Let's see. First thing that comes to mind is the French love to sieve them or crumble them over salads. They call it mimosa because it looks like the little beads. You know, the mimosa flower is these small little, and then just do that with it. The other thing that's really delicious is to turn them into sort of a little spread, a mousse or a pate, if you will. Add a bit of mayonnaise, add lemon. In so many words, do a very classy egg salad. I would add a bit of chutney, something like the old-fashioned Major Grey, you know, that has little chunks of fruit, a bit of tartness, not super hot. I would add a little bit of mayo. I would add nuts, and I would add minced celery and a bit of onion, and I would just spread it on things like sliced cucumbers. And
that sounds fabulous.
Yeah, and you know what that would be great in, too, if you want to really do something tedious, but it really is killer? Stuff cherry tomatoes with it. Yeah, I know. I mean, you'll be there all day. You usually eat so many while you're doing it, there's none left for anybody else. But it's that kind of combination is really wonderful when you want to put it into something little. But just spreading it on anything, zucchini, put it on, you know, as I said, the cucumber. That would be fabulous on thin slices of cantaloupe. A beautiful contrast of sweet and savory.
Oh, yum. Yeah. We're going to have that on our table this weekend.
Well, there you go. I'll do the guacamole in the eggs, and you do that. And then, you know, one day we'll get together and we'll have a whole egg.
Great. That's wonderful. Thanks so much.
Hey, thank you for a great idea, Tom. Take care. Bye.
Bye-bye.
You can reach us at 800-537-5252. We're open for just about anything. And you can also send us an email. Go to splendidtable.org. Eileen's calling from St. Petersburg, Florida. Eileen, is it as hot as the devil down there?
It really is. It is.
Because I know whenever it feels really bad here, I think of what you folks must go through at this time of year. And
well, a lot of humidity and a lot of rain right now.
Well, yeah, think of the flowers growing. Did you have a question, ma'am?
I do. I have a question about cookbooks. I have a stepdaughter who is 14, and she doesn't have a lot of kitchen experience, but she is willing to try most any kind of food.
Uh-huh.
And so I'd like to get her a gift of a cookbook that covers, you know, kind of basic techniques and standard recipes, but also something that she can use for a resource in the future. I have a cookbook that I got at around that age, and I still use it.
What is it?
It went out of print in 1982.
So, what's the book, though? I'm curious.
It's my cookbook is called Easy Basics for Good Cooking, and I actually learned how to bake bread using that cookbook. It just has a lot of good photos and you know, kind of techniques.
There's a lot out there now that is showing. Because I think pictures are really important here, showing and telling the basics in a way that I think would be interesting for someone of that age.
Right.
You know? And, you know, there's a publisher in England. I'm not exactly sure how to pronounce it. I think it's Dorling Kindersley, but you're going to recognize the logo because the logo is DK. They do a lot of books, and there have been books done by very good cooks on the basics, you know, just the basics.
Okay.
A long time ago, the New York Times columnist Mark Bittman did How to Cook Everything, but that's not a step-by-step thing.
Mm-hmm.
That's right. Not the pictures.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because some other, you know, more advanced cookbooks just assume that you know the difference between chopping and mincing and that kind of thing. And then there's plenty of cookbooks for younger kids that are a little too simple, maybe.
Yeah, yeah. So, she's 14. She's older. She's smart.
Right.
Marion Cunningham did a book on basics. This came out about 10 years ago. Can you hold on 1 minute?
Sure.
Hold on 1 second.
Sure.
I was thinking of a book that I had in the closet here in the studio.
Mm-hmm.
It's called My Cooking Class, except it's Indian food basics, and
okay.
It's very well done.
Okay.
But I know there are others, and let me look at this publisher for a minute, because this may be the key.
Okay.
Firefly is the publisher.
Okay.
Now, Firefly has done My Cooking Class for other things as well.
Okay.
So check out Firefly Publishers. I think they're here in the States, but one way or the other, publishing today is always international.
Okay, right.
So,
well, that cookbook sounds like something I might want to get for myself.
I think you might like it, really. It's very basic.
Wonderful.
Okay.
Thank you so much for your help, Lynn.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye. These beginner books, I'm going to have a list pasted in front of me because my mind just goes, you know, blank. But what's really great about the past decade in publishing of cookbooks is it used to be having pictures in books was a rare thing because it was very expensive. And now those pictures are, you know, almost everything is illustrated. And when you don't know what you're doing, you know, when you don't know what a simmer looks like, when you don't know what it's supposed to, you know, behave like, you want pictures. And also you want, obviously, someone telling you this is what it should look like, this is what it should sound like, and this is what it should taste like. And if a recipe doesn't tell you that, you don't want to buy the book. Thomas is on the line from Lawrenceville, Georgia. Thomas?
How are you?
I am good. How are you, and what would you like to talk about?
I'm fine, thank you. Thanks for taking my call.
Oh, you're welcome.
I wanted to talk to you about pairing foods together. I've been doing a couple of dinner parties and different things like that.
Right.
What's a good way to put things together?
Well, I think the thing is, with a main dish, you think of what is going to be the star in terms of flavor. And by the way, this doesn't necessarily have to be the meat. In fact, these days, you know, there's no meat on a lot of main dishes.
Yeah.
But the point is, what's going to be the thing with the most complex or assertive flavors? So let's use an example of you're doing pulled pork.
Mm-hmm.
Now, classic with that, if you were in North Carolina, is very crunchy, sweet, sour, very simple coleslaw. Why? The pork is rich in fat. It has interesting, you know, flavors playing in it. Even without a sauce, it's a kind of thing that just resonates in your mouth. And what you want to go with it is something that's a high contrast because you want that accent. And that's where that vinegary, slightly sweet, crunchy coleslaw, not the creamy, soppy kind.
Yeah.
So you want one thing that has complex or deep or interesting flavors. It's an important taste in your mouth. It dominates, okay? That could be very spicy rice with black beans, or it could be a piece of roasted meat, or it could be something like a dish of corn and tomatoes and peppers and spices, and it is the thing that you really want everyone to focus on.
Gotcha.
All right? So that's your important thing. Now, you want with that at least one neutral, something that tastes distinctly of itself and is a contrast in flavor. So if you had something very meaty and very rich, you might want to make something as simple as fresh carrots that you have steamed, okay?
Right.
And you have just turned them in the smallest amount of butter with a bit of fresh basil in it and salt. That's it. Because you'll taste the carrot. And the carrot will just be this beautiful, pure thing that will be in contrast to that more complex flavor. You following me?
Yep, I do.
Okay.
That makes sense.
Now, the other flavor that you want is something that is directly the opposite of what your main event is. So if the main event is, you know, rich and meaty, this would be something like a very simple steamed spinach with garlic. You see the difference? Yep. Very clean, very fresh. It might be something raw. I mean, it might be something like a vegetable salad at this time of year. It might be the tomato and the cucumber and a bit of raw onion that you've marinated, you know, so it's not going to hit you over the head. Just sitting there on the plate, it's the fresh, bright, it's the neutral, and then it's the complex.
And they can all be different parts of the meal, too. Like, you don't have to have them all on the same plate.
But you don't have to, exactly. But it's. I'm sorry, I don't mean to make this complicated, but think contrast. You're building something that's complex and an attention getter, right? Something really simple, pure, and it just sings on its own, and it's neutral, and something that is the contrast, the opposite flavor of family from the main event. And then you've got it.
Thank you.
You're welcome. I hope it helps.
It does.
Okay, great.
Have a good day.
Oh, you too. Take care. You can call us at 800-537-5252. You can send us an email at splendidtable.org or track us down on Facebook and Twitter. I don't want to insult those wildly inventive cooks out there who have done these new wave burgers, but I have to tell you, no decent burger should have to endure slathers of things like vanilla sea urchin butter or blueberry anchovy foam or 10 chili mayo. The great burger is about ketchup. And the dreamiest ketchups are homemade. Some of the best homemade versions come from Karen Solomon. She's the food writer who lives to preserve. Karen's written Jam It, Pickle It, Cure It. Karen, it's great to have you back.
Thank you, Lynn.
Yeah, I'd like to talk about ketchup. First of all, it's, you know, the all-American condiment.
Mm-hmm.
Secondly, the ketchup that we have is usually tomato ketchup. But there's a whole backdrop of ketchups that have happened all over the world. So what are your favorite kinds of ketchup?
Oh, well, of course, you know, the red stuff. But I have to admit, I prefer my homemade to that particular national brand that has become synonymous with the meaning of ketchup. But I am actually even a bigger fan of plum ketchup, which, you know, in summer, I love going to the farmers markets. We get so many wonderful varieties of plums here in California. And a homemade plum ketchup is, it's tart, it's savory, it's sweet and acidic. In my mind, that's actually a perfect ketchup.
Well, so what are the basics of doing it?
You start with some plums, and you boil them down to kind of render their flesh. You know, you boil them to burst the skins and to cook the pulp, and then you strain that to get rid of all the skins and to get rid of the pits and everything.
Mm-hmm.
And then you take that puree and you mix it with a little bit of orange marmalade, which adds a really nice citrusy note and also just makes it a little bit tartar. And then you add some of the warm spices that we tend to think of with ketchup, a little cinnamon, some cardamom. I also add a little bit of star anise, maybe a bay leaf or two. And then to balance out the sweetness of the fruit, I always like to add either onions or garlic or both, just something to you know, make it taste mm-hmm. that much more savory.
Right.
And then you cook it down into a really, really delicious sauce. And in our house, it goes pretty quick.
Okay, now the big question. How do you do the great all-American ketchup?
You know, this is sort of a funny thing, but I actually prefer the taste of my own homemade canned ketchup when I start with canned tomatoes. There's something about the starting with canned tomatoes that they're kind of halfway prepared for you.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they break down a lot more easily, and it just loans itself a better flavor. And, of course, the finished product cooks up a lot more quickly as well. But basically, I puree canned tomatoes, and I brown some onion. And that's a really important step because, you know, the taste of raw onion versus browned onion, that adds a lot of sweetness. It adds a lot of flavor complexity to the ketchup as well. And then I combine the two with a little tea bag of spices. So I like to put in some cardamom, some cloves, a little bay leaf, black peppercorn, a little star anise, you know, those warm spices
right,
that we think
right.
of kind of associated with a ketchup. And then I let that boil into the vegetable puree and then also kind of let it steep for a while. And then, of course, I think what makes a ketchup is the addition of vinegar and sugar. I like to use a little brown sugar because it has that nice, you know, that nice kind of caramelizing
mm-hmm,
note.
Mm-hmm.
And also some champagne vinegar, because which maybe seems like overkill, I guess, for a ketchup. But I think that, again, it's not too aggressive, not too assertive. I'm a big fan of white distilled vinegar in general for pickling. But
yeah.
in my ketchup, I like that tang just a little bit mellowed.
Mm-hmm.
It's delicious.
Great. Karen, thank you.
Lynn, thank you.
Karen Solomon's book is Jam It, Pickle It, Cure It. For her homemade ketchup recipe, head to the website, splendidtable.org. Well, that's the show for this week. Thanks for being with us. You have a great week. And until next time, let me leave you with this from the first Heinz ketchup ad in 1876. It said, "Blessed relief for mother and the other women in the household." The Splendid Table is produced by APM American Public Media. Head over to splendidtable.org for additional information on anything you heard here today. You're going to find information on our latest ebooks and podcasts. There are loads of recipes and ideas. And be sure to register for our free weekly e-newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen. It's our weekly attempt to bring you good food midweek. And it's all at splendidtable.org. Our show is produced by Jennifer Russell with help from Laura Kalibi. Our editor and technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Our website is managed by Andy Cruz. Sally Swift is our managing producer. See you next week. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto-Casper, and this is APM American Public Media.